Hello, I'm Rich Kilgariff. Welcome to Bookomi. Now, the OMI in Bookomi stands for the original memorable insights that we find in books when we connect with the most wanted minds in business, science, technology, arts, and culture. In this episode,
I'm Poe Baronson.
And I'm Arvind Gupta, authors of Decoding the World.
And this is our OMI for Bookomi.
Poe Bronson and Arvind Gupta are Silicon Valley insiders, joined together by IndieBio, the science accelerator that Arvind founded in 2014 and where Poe is now managing director.
IndieBio was founded on the principle that nobody was looking earlier at these scientists with just paper ideas and evaluating a paper idea or even like an early prototype or something, but not much, right? And then saying, yeah, that's a world-changing idea. Let's partner and let's do that.
Our sort of psychology of pessimism that makes us into fighters and drives us to action is how we end up doing things that seem optimistic.
One day I'm going to die, and on my tombstone, we will write all the companies I ever invested in, and then you will know who I am as a person.
They are also existential outsiders, futurists who want to know why we are here and where we are going. And in their book, Decoding the World, A Roadmap for the Questioner, they embark on a Socratic dialogue of sorts, texting, talking, and writing essays that tackle the big science stories of today and tomorrow.
COVID has forced a real understanding of why we're doing this and the intense need for the solutions that we're looking for. And I think the rest of the world is seeing that now. So in that sense, COVID has accelerated a process that I thought would take a decade and compressed it into a year.
When COVID hit, over the course of March, Arvind and I and our team, we did 8 COVID companies, and we, like, unbelievable speed. We looked at 600 different ideas, and we did the best 8 that we could, and they're doing very well, and like one's in clinical trials, and testing companies are out there. But it was this sort of like, even go even faster, experiment, iterate, try things. Don't just sit there and study. Like, you could study COVID forever. You could study COVID for 50 years. What the world needed was action, right? And so the end of the book was my transformation. Now I'm managing director of IndieBio, but it was actually oddly important and valuable to me to have gone through that transition and learned to be, you know, the managing director who takes action rather than who studies things.
Yeah, it's interesting. It really comes across in the book that you're battling against an inertia against the situation that was suddenly everything's put on hold in tech and industry at large and the status quo. The example that stands out for me is the problem of bees and collapsing hives.
We have a company that we created called BeeFlow. You know, everybody's upset about the fact that the bees are dying and there's this colony collapse and everyone is trying to figure out what is causing it. And there are, in fact, so many things causing it, from pesticides to climate change to agricultural practices. And we had just a very different approach, which is it possible to make a difference here without knowing what causes it? Because bees, just like humans, have an immune system. And if we could boost their immune system, they could sort of survive all challenges. And the answer lied at the interface from where bees and the plants that they land on share little amino acid compounds. And our company, BeeFlow, went down to Southern California, went out here in Northern California, tried to get all these pollinators to use their little chimichurri, they called it, this herb mix. No one would touch it. So they had to become a pollinator themselves. And now in blueberries and in almonds and raspberries with the biggest farms in California, just 2 years later, they're now a beekeeping service, a pollinator. And their bees are doing amazing and they're growing incredibly fast. And it's so fun, but it's also kind of a torture, Rich, because what we're tortured by is why isn't the whole world using BeeFlow's chimichurri now? Like, they're still not all doing it. Like, the company's growing, but like, there are answers to the solutions right to all the, there are answers to all these problems right in front of us. There are answers to all of climate change right in front of us, but why don't we use them?
And that's the inertia that we talk about, right? Like throughout the book, it, you know, sometimes more directly than others, but that's exactly the inertia. There are solutions.
You say one of the big issues, in fact, the big issue that you deal with is climate change. And you talk about it a lot. It preoccupies you a lot throughout the book. The big problem is we can't agree on the problem. How do we change? I'm sort of leaping in here at the deep end. How do we change the biology of human behavior to agree on the problem?
So I'm not sure you can, Richard. I think that's behavior is so hard to change. And it's human to consume, and it's human to want more as you come out of poverty. At the very top of the economic strata, you have people that can change your behaviors in certain ways. But when you're coming out of nothing and wanting something, that those are the people. And when you do that for 5 billion people, 4 billion people across the planet, you could see that's the inertia. And so it's not the 100, you know, it's not the 10 million hipsters that are gonna, you know, eat a veggie burger instead. We need to solve for the 5 billion. And that's the point. And I think that's where reprogramming biology in order to reinvent production for, so everyone could have their burger, right? And not lose the planet at the same time. These are some of the insights that we're talking about. And no one really thought that way because until recently, that wasn't really possible, right? That was not something you could do, you know, but now with genetic engineering and other technologies, it's something we could explore as a solution set. And that's some of the things that we did at IndieBio.
It sounds like a hard place to work, but a really fun place to work. How do you keep it like that over the years? Because you've matured since Mike Moritz said that you were suicidal to set something like IndieBio up, haven't you? You've matured as a company. How do you keep it feeling gritty and fresh?
My job here is to keep the indie in IndieBio. You know, my training for this, just to understand, isn't from like the businesses I've been running all these years. It's from organizing the artistic communities of San Francisco, where I've also been a writer for a long time. And it's understanding that what Arvin created here, sometimes these companies would come out and announce themselves. There's one that was doing rhino horn without the rhino. And people would be like, is that a company or is that performance art? And it was the fact that what Arvin was creating, the companies themselves, Meat Without a Cow, would challenge the very idea of what is science and what is art, created a unique kind of capability that required not just sort of rigorous thinking, but an insane amount of creativity to imagine it in the first place. And so it is this, we have events, you know, 3 nights a week, and like we're the only venture capital firm with fans, people come in, obviously not right now, but we create a high volume of interactions where everybody who's a friend of IndieBio, and that includes you now, like people can just wander in at any time. And we all know their name and we're all welcome them and give hugs. And it's a very different culture than was created in other realms of genetics and biotech. We are looser and crazier than the most fun advertising firm you've heard about.
Your chapter on memory, you say how you in lockdown, you feel like your brain has been photocopied each day. We've got no landmark events, have we? We're not keeping parts of our brain busy. You say imagination is the reversal of memory, which is, I think, is a beautiful way of putting it. How do you two keep your brains alive in lockdown in terms of the restricted experience that we're having and we're making fewer memories?
It's hard. Arvin and I think we both have been saying a lot was that once the book was written, you know, finished in the spring, maybe at the beginning of the summer, we were missing writing because writing was this place of our imaginations to run and to go. And, you know, when we close our eyes at night or when we walk down the street, we can have rich, wild interior lives. Or you have nothing. You just grab your phone and look at some pretty pictures. Like we do control, but we need that input. We need that stimulus in order for our minds to really go and connect. And I think Arvin and I do it by calling each other every night and running through really rapidly, tons of ideas, tons of new technologies we want to look at, tons of new companies, but tons of wild ideas that we just think about and we download and we let what we call is our quadratic speed up. When Arvin and I met, we were like yin and yang, our minds. And we just we crave it, we hunger for it. So we do our best to let it go. On the weekends, like on Saturday night, I try to sleep a long time and have really wild dreams. Like these are really important to our work.
Arvin, you are the yin or the yang in that relationship, and you both have fascinating histories and unconventional histories. Arvin, you opted out really in your 20s for a while and started questioning life's design, its codes, and the codes of human life, DNA. Whatever our processing power, whatever the size of our data set, isn't certainty what Silicon Valley craves, what investors want for control and scale? And you seem to want to swim against that.
Yeah, well, there can't be certainty. There isn't certainty. The universe is uncertain. And so if we create oftentimes these structures to create the illusion of certainty, but I think it's something that's core to us as artists, and in trying to solve these problems, is variant perception. The idea that you could see something that other people don't simply because you have a different frame of view or a different viewpoint. And that comes, like you said, Richard, from all your experiences, your data set and your processing power mixed together, which is why I think experiences matter so much. As I was becoming a designer, there was a critical moment in my life where I wasn't sure if I wanted to go into design after being a scientist. And the person who was teaching me design said simply, well, you have a lot of life experiences and that's gonna translate into your artwork in a way that others can't. And that gave me the courage. Another one is base jumping. I mean, there were times I would be on the exit point in San Francisco and others, on top of a building in the middle of the night, you know, just by myself, wind whistling through the structure of the building. And I was like, well, you know, 30% chance I go to the hospital if I jump off of this, 10% chance I go to the morgue. Okay, I'll do it, right? Or sometimes I've looked at that calculus and said, no, time to walk down tonight, right? So I think that's what gives you the richness of experience. And I think it's important, like, you don't take risk for the thrill of it. That's the, you know, you kind of get away with something. Sometimes you could feel like that might give you a thrill. But for me, it's being in a beautiful place. Jumping off a dam is a very beautiful place to be. Jiu-jitsu, going inside of yourself in an uncontrolled fight where you are trying to control something that's fundamentally uncontrollable. And going inside of yourself, those are beautiful things. And they teach you a lot about yourself and the world around you. And that's why it's so critical and important to me.
Arvin has taught me so much here. You know, I think by default, I'm a person, I guess I grew up with a lot of uncertainty. I got comfortable with it. I also, you know, having worked in finance like Arvin, you know, got used to the risk and the speed. Nevertheless, over the course of this decade, I was dying for a plan. Dying for a plan as to how we would get through the next, you know, two decades with climate change and rise of China and the war on truth and genetic revolution and AI that was going to attack us. And when I came to IndieBio, I learned there is no plan, just a way. And my acceptance of uncertainty became really grounded, because while we want to essentially program cells, program the body just the way computer programmers do, using the code of life itself, at its core and in the underlying physics, and this is something Arvin taught me a lot about, which is that no matter how much, yes, we can program all that, it's still riding on physics, and physics has quantum indeterminacy in it. And we'll never really control bodies or the Earth's ecosystem the way we control computers. They'll resemble each other, but the uncertainty at its core must be accepted in order to even act, in order to even experiment.
You talk about Silicon Valley as a congruent, fluid, revolving circuit of conversations that happen in the present. It's like a brain in itself, living only in the moment, sparking and connecting. Every night, people in Silicon Valley are gathering and talking and having your brain salons, etc. But they're not anymore. They're not doing that. What will this do to the quality of ideas coming out of the Valley over the next 3 years?
What we're talking about essentially is Silicon Valley's unconscious. They're all day long, people talk business, talk ideas, brag about this, explore that. But at night, sort of the party circuit of IndieBio. But when I say party circuit, I mean, like, we're talking about stuff on little islands and boats and everything from Burning Man style to the Russian bathhouses to people who have tea parties and take baths with sound. And they have this chattering conversation that kind of goes nowhere, but it's very much like a dream state. It's Silicon Valley's unconscious mind. And it is out of this soup of this unconscious that actually now and then, out of nowhere, great insights pop up and new ideas sort of take root. And without this unconscious process, driven totally by the much more Apollonian day mind, Silicon Valley's sort of real next sense of a turn will be missing. Like essentially the creative side of Silicon Valley has been deeply suppressed during this epidemic, even though it's going well and people are saying hi and meeting every day and money is moving. I think we're going to have a long hangover before people really revive that unconscious process.
Arvind, how does that affect you and your future? Do you see things becoming less adventurous?
These communities are very resilient, and you know, thanks to technology, we haven't gone straight to no communication. It's evolving. There's new communication styles, right? There's like online town, which is like a avatar version of Zoom where you walk around and people's voices fade in and out. Like, we find a way, right? And I think that's the important thing. It is part of the DNA of the culture to have these touch points and mixing grounds. Now, has it slowed down? Absolutely. The mutation rate is down. But the challenges have increased. And so I think the audacity of founders, of entrepreneurs and scientists out there thinking, oh man, like the California wildfires have really pushed me over the edge. I'm going to try this crazy idea at my lab. And if it halfway works, I'll go look for funding. Between the two and this huge shift in mindset, you know, being accelerated by COVID and all the wildfires, is very hard to deny at this point, you know, that this is not a problem for 20 years in the future. This is a problem for today. Climate change is now a problem for today, which will start to create a lot more creativity around it. Something that capitalism is good at is solving problems in front of its face. Something it's bad at is solving problems far out. And so I'm hoping that these early warning signs are going to create an amazing amount of creative thinking against it.
Everybody knows this feeling of, you know, did you just consume or did you do any original thinking today? Did you just take in, you know, the TV shows, the stuff on your phone, or did you ever have, you know, an original thought? As Arvind's now been going from the ivory basement of IndieBio in San Francisco to Sand Hill Road, what I've watched in him is this sort of like, sure, he now, everybody sends all these great companies to him. Over the course of like a month, it's like they all seem so practical and they're going to solve this short-term thing. And Arvind has been like dying and looking for like, who's thinking bigger? You know, who's thinking beyond? And now and then he finds someone, and that's why we talk at night, to think beyond, to have a prepared mind.
How does that manifest itself in terms of investment cycles? Do you think the investment cycle as it is today with VCs needs to change in order to almost change the framework for thinking and creativity?
That's an interesting question. There's two ways to go about it, right? One is change the structure that exists today, and the other one is to add to it. Given our our exploration of inertia and energy that goes into changing things that already exist, I think it's almost better to add to the cycle. So you just have to go earlier and earlier. IndieBio was founded on the principle that nobody was looking earlier at these scientists with just paper ideas and evaluating a paper idea or even like an early prototype or something, but not much, right? And then saying, yeah, that's a world-changing idea. Let's partner and let's do that. You know, one of the things I'm thinking about right now very deeply is how do you go even earlier than IndieBio? Right? How do you help people still in academia, right, have ideas and act on them? It's always action. And that's what allows you to create a longer funnel that of opportunity. Every layer of that layer cake is specialized at taking a certain amount of risk. You know, changing them to take a different risk set is it's hard. If you just open up more, you know, have a bigger bottom layer, then I think it could work. And you're just starting earlier rather than getting everyone to think further out. That being said, it would be nice. And one of the reasons I'm on Sand Hill Road is to help other people start to think bigger and to think longer in terms of returns rather than, you know, some just hot gaming company or something like that that'll make a return in a couple of years.
I've got an idea for the name of your earlier IndieBio. I think it should be called KindieBio.
I love it.
You can have that for nothing. Well, no, actually, no, you can't have it for nothing.
there you go.
Damn, I said it. Obviously, I enjoyed the whole experience of being inside your heads or between your heads for at least 3 or 5 hours. And it's quite an experience. And that's what the joy of reading a book like this is. Books are people in print. And towards the end of the book, after enjoying your company so much, the piece responding to a Newsweek article, AI is the biggest threat to humanity because, as you say, it found the hate we were trying to hide. That's a fairly Hobbesian opinion of mankind, suggesting we need social contracts to control ourselves. And it kind of punched me in the mind when I read it. Camus and Kafka references aside, I was caught up in your positive energy, but this was dark stuff. Do you think you need to be dark and intense in order to enjoy and appreciate the lightness of life? What do you default to, both of you, darkness or lightness?
People say they feel optimistic when they come to IndieBio. Like I'm talking about venture capitalists. I'm talking about people who run foundations. They just come and they see the scientists working. They see the ideas and they walk, celebrities come in and they walk away feeling optimistic. Weirdly though, Arvin and I think we're pessimistic. Alain de Botton is a friend of both of ours. And he teaches this element of that through pessimism, then so much surprises you and gives you joy. Because you're not expecting greatness out of everything. And I think that's probably where I lie on this, which is that it is this sort of built pessimistic mindset that makes me fight so hard. Armin's a jiu-jitsu fighter. Like we both, we do our best when we fight. And not fight mean, fight fairly. It taps into a part of ourselves. So our sort of psychology of pessimism that makes us into fighters and drives us to action is how we end up doing things that seem optimistic.
We're brought up, and I think we're just mentally made this way as human beings, to not trust people who are over positive entirely, because you want to be able to see both sides and then accept whatever comes. It's a stoicism, I suppose. Arvind, what about you?
Yeah, it's important to see the world for what it is. As scientists, we use questions to discover truth, right? And the truth may not be what we expect or what we want, and that's okay. It's the that to me is the heartbeat of the book. These questions are driving us to explore the world, driving us to the solutions we see, and driving us to react to what we learn. And I think, you know, one of the joys of writing that I found, you know, as this is my first book, was how much you learn. You know, I think beginning Poe, you know, I tried writing, like, you know, Poe really mentored me through this process in a deep and profound way. He changed my thinking. As he said, he came to IndieBio and learned action. I learned how to really push and push and push on a thought or an idea until it became real artwork. And I think the biggest point there, right, is you can't just tell people what you know, right? That's super boring. but if you explore and learn something together, then it starts to sparkle. That AI chapter didn't know where it was going to go. I was exploring what AI could possibly mean and take this idea very seriously. And it came to that. It came to that, that this realization of training sets. Training sets come from data that exists in the world. Those data sets lead us to biased algorithms and things like that. So it's an observation. It's an observation and a conclusion and something that we can change. So now we have we've identified a problem that we can go out and try to correct. And that gives me a lot of excitement and optimism and hope, because there's something we can now change. My training as a designer is fundamentally around identifying problems and then solving them. And that's what, to me, questions leading to truth can get to.
Well, Poe Bronson and Arvind Gupta, thank you for sharing your OMI with Bokomi today.
Thank you so much for having us, Richard.
Thank you, Richard.
Poe and Arvind's book, Decoding the World, A Roadmap for the Questioner, is available to buy now. Just follow the link in the description of the podcast. If you'd like to be the first to hear and meet the brightest minds behind the smartest new nonfiction, sign up to our monthly Most Wanted email at bokomi.com and subscribe to this podcast wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Richard Kilgariff. Stay safe, keep your distance, and remember, as Poe and Arvind said, nobody is an expert in the unknown.